Please note that due to the graphic and adult nature of this topic, this show is not recommended for children or sensitive listeners.
This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. This is part two in a series I have done on paedophilia. Is it a fetish? Is it an illness? Is it a choice? If we can understand it, we know what we are dealing with. And if we know what we're dealing with, we can look at ways to educate and protect the vulnerable in our communities. This week, I am looking at the brain science behind paedophilia. My guest expert is Dr. James Cantor. Dr. Cantor is an American-Canadian clinical psychologist and sexologist. He specializes in hypersexuality and paraphilias. Don't worry about that word. We're going to ask him about it. He's a former senior scientist with the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. Good morning, Dr. Cantor. Thank you for your time. What are paraphilias?
It's a pretty general term that refers to any of the really, really, really atypical sexual interest patterns. These are people who are interested into something really out of the ordinary. For example, the exhibitionists, subway flashers, for example, or voyeurs, people who want to peep on other people. And of course, most dramatic versions of them are the people who are the sexual sadists, people who derive genuine sexual pleasure from other people's pain, severe genuine pain, and pedophiles, people who are sexually aroused by children. Those latter two, as I say, are the most discussed because those pose the most danger potentially to other people.
Why did you study the brains of pedophiles?
Mostly by luck, really. I mean, my whole trip into sex research and becoming a sex researcher really was by accident. When I was young, I was really just curious. I started actually as a computer scientist. I was a very nerdy, math-oriented kind of a kid. So science was my assumed future. But then, you know, and as I pursued it in university, I actually figured out one of the big developmental courses for me in my own life was figuring out and being able to deal with that I was gay. Ah, okay, big somersault in life. Maybe I don't really want to be a computer scientist. And I decided the other extreme, I'll become a psychologist. And the last year of a PhD studies in psychology is to do an internship, a full-time clinical year. And I got into, in Canada, what was one of their top internship sites. It was the Clark Institute of Psychiatry, which just at that time was merging with several other hospitals to become the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. So I went there, and by sheer coincidence, there was a researcher there, psychologist there, Ray Blanchard, that I was working with. And he was curious about what made pedophiles pedophiles, what made people who are sexually interested in children, what made them different. Now, by sheer coincidence, during that crossover time that I had between computer science and psychology, I knew it was really, really competitive to get into psychology school, and it would be useful to have a couple years work experience. Well, the work experience that I got was as a research assistant in a neuropsychology lab. So I actually, for that job, learned several of the brain function tests. So all of a sudden, here I was with a guy with an interest in human sexuality, a background in computer science and able to do statistical analyses, and also trained to do these brain functioning kinds of tests. So I was just, by sheer fluke, I had the right combination of skills in the right place where it was applicable. Well, 20 years later, right, it was now a long series of studies and grants and collaborations between me and Ray Blanchard, and then he retired and I took over the lab and so on. So really, my curiosity was, again, started in a very natural place. As a gay kid, I just wondered, why am I different? How am I different? What does this change? Does it not? What's going on? But then once exposed to a broader range and got to see the many, many different kinds of sexualities, never mind just what we essentially now call plain vanilla gay, that then made me broaden my question. Instead of just what makes me different or what makes gay different from straight, I now had the general question, what makes anybody into whatever it is that they're into?
What were your findings?
they came in stages. This was a provocative idea in its way, although less provocative amongst scientists who, you know, could look at the whole situation with a bit more dispassion. The way any kind of science works is with a series of successive approximations. The facility I was in was a clinical facility. It was sex offenders, mostly, including many, many pedophiles. Once they were caught, convicted, served their time, and released to parole and probation, they were first assigned to the clinic where I was for assessment, and from there, you know, to handle whatever mental health issues there were, including psychological treatments for dealing with their sex offense history, for engaging in what was still called then and often still called now relapse prevention. Then the research was, all right, we've been doing this for 18 months. Let's look at one great big group, everybody who is coming through with all of the clinical information we have available. Numbers of offenses, the results on the different kinds of tests that we gave, and see if there are any patterns. So at first we had, you know, our advantages were that we had a very large sample and a very systematic process. And in that context, we did indeed start seeing patterns. And these were our first research studies. One of the first things that we looked at and found was a pattern with IQ. Offenders against children, on average, would have a lower IQ than people who would offend against older children or against adults. There was a correlation. You know, the lower the IQ, the younger very often their victims were. Intriguing, not at all specific. You know, we could come up with, you know, causes effect. What we thought was effect is actually cause. This is just a correlation. Tantalizing, good reason to continue with the next level of research, but not by itself anything that would prove anything specific. I often compare IQ kind of like the blood pressure of the brain. If there's, you know, some association with IQ, there something's going on, but we don't know what. We need to keep looking, which is exactly what we did. One of the questions we had, of course, was, is X leading to Y? Is Y leading to X? Is it just less intelligent people are more likely to get caught, and so therefore more likely to be in our sample? Entirely, entirely possible. Could it be that people who were caught end up more depressed because they were incarcerated for many years, because they've been abandoned by their families, so they're just not trying as hard? Also possible. So we started looking for other kinds of things, their educational histories, and we started seeing the same pattern. So whatever was going on, it wasn't recent, it goes back in their history. And one of the pivotal things, something that really said, ah, there's something deeper going on, was the kind of thing that nobody really today would actually think of, except a scientist who studies the brain. Handedness, left-handedness versus right-handedness. Now, what makes that so interesting is the only thing that controls handedness is brain organization. What we found was, you know, in the regular population and among mainstream people, 8 to 10%-ish are non-right-handed. But it was over 30% of the pedophiles. That's not a fluke. The only way to get a great big excess like that is if there was something going on in basic brain organization. And the lateralization of the brain happens roughly late first trimester of gestation, before birth. Now, there's no direct association between handedness and pedophilia, but it's the kind of a great big clue that says whatever chain of events it is that ultimately leads to pedophilia, the first links of that chain are in the brain and in the womb. And it was that kind of now repeated, replicated evidence suggesting there's something deep and meaningful here that then got us our research funding to go, I'll call it whole hog, and start taking MRIs and looking actually inside the brain. If I take a group of these pedophiles, you know, very carefully assessed, all with very careful testing in order to know very specifically, you know, exactly what kind of pedophile they are and so on, and compare them with a carefully selected control group, then we can start saying, okay, what in the brain might make these groups different? And that led to my first MRI study.
Can I clarify, did you say that all pedophiles are left-handed?
No, not all. It's about 30%, somewhere between 30 and 35%. There's a statistical association, and when we look closer in it, we find these various risk factors adding up, which help us unpack the actual system to say, ah, it was this which led to that, which led to that, which led to that. Here's the outcome. Now that we understand the whole chain, we can look at, you know, where we might have opportunities to break that chain.
What percentage of the world's population are left-handed versus right-handed? I'm just trying to get a sense of how significant this 30% was in your sample.
Sure. Among the mainstream, it's somewhere between 8 to 10% of men, slightly lower among women.
What findings?
These subtle clues that the brain was related, that this wasn't just, you know, histories of them themselves being victims. It wasn't, you know, other things in their history that we could find. Yeah. The only clues we had that made a consistent pattern were things that were indirectly related to brain function. So on the basis of that, we were then able to conduct our first studies. We got the financial support to conduct, you know, direct brain studies to look actually at the brain. Now, there are some subtleties in the design of that kind of a project that most people assume the wrong way. I didn't, because one can't, just take a sample of pedophiles, as I say, most of whom, not all of whom, but most of whom have committed an offense of some kind, either child pornography consumption or actually touching or some inappropriate behavior involving a child. If I took just a sample of them and I compared them to a sample of regular everyday men, the female sex offenders are so rare that I didn't have a large enough sample to conduct an analysis, so we stuck to men. If I compared these pedophilic men to non-pedophilic men and I found some differences, I have what we call a confound. These people aren't different just in being pedophilic or not, saying, ah, these are the differences, that's pedophilia in the brain. Well, I also have people who committed crimes versus not. It's quite possible that what I'm seeing in the brain is the willingness to break the law or antisociality or psychopathy or disinhibition or inability to control themselves. So I was very careful in who I picked as my control group. I didn't compare these pedophilic offenders with regular everyday men. I compared the pedophilic offenders with people who committed other kinds of crime. I compared people who convicted crimes and are pedophilic with people who committed crimes and are not pedophilic. So when I compare these two groups, because I'm comparing criminal to criminal, none of the differences I run into can be associated with criminality itself. And what I found ultimately after running the study was nothing. I couldn't find a thing that differed in one set of brains than the other. But actually, I was really, really lucky. I had two very talented research assistants who continued, you know, running other kinds of analyses that normally, you know, we just don't bother with. They were just looking at parts of the brain that were pure support, didn't have anything to do with it, with upper brain or cognitive functioning and so on. Ding! Something huge came out in this connective tissue that nobody ever paid any attention to. The analyses that we had initially done and showed no difference. We did, again, the analyses that everybody does, as if, you know, all neuroscientists are somehow all going to the same bar. The standard analyses well known in that science, which is essentially an analysis of the gray matter of the brain, the surface of the brain, you know, the most highly evolved, where the complex cognitive functions all happen. This is the part where the reading area is, where the speech area is, where vision processing is, and so on. And when those parts on the surface of the outermost layer of the brain are knocked out, various cognitive functions of the person are knocked out. All of those layers, all of those neurons, everything on the surface of the brain is all connected through white matter. If you remember, you know, old biology, what a neuron looks like, it's that big starry kind of thing, you know, which sends one long tail, the axon. Well, that axon gets wrapped in a fatty tissue, so it looks white, so it's called white matter when it's bundled together. In the brain, it's called a tract, and when that bundle goes down the spinal cord, it's now called a nerve. So what our analyses found was differences in the white matter rather than in the gray matter. Nothing's ever in white matter. It's cabling tissue, but gosh darn. So we started looking up, well, which fibers is it? What's getting connected? What's this connective tissue connecting to? So we now ran another series of analyses to trace each point from where it is at the areas of the brain that fibrous chunk connects are all the same areas of the brain that light up somebody's sexually aroused. All of a sudden, this is no coincidence. Right. Now we're going back, you know, 10, almost 15 years where in those days, nobody was looking at white matter. So over the 10 following years, now there's been this explosion, but I wouldn't have guessed it. It made no sense to us. But once two and two went together, it was, aha, this can't be a coincidence.
You said that this developed in utero towards the end of the first trimester.
I always hesitate to make any kind of really solid conclusion. I offer that simply as the conclusion that assumes the least. That's the simplest conclusion.
Does that answer the question as to whether pedophiles are born or made?
The evidence so far, we have solid evidence indicating made, but we have no evidence to say this is the end of the story. We have no idea what other things developmentally might be interacting with this. It might be somebody born with a vulnerability to it. And so other factors over the course of life that kick in, either social factors, environmental factors, environmental biological factors, a stress during life that affects brain development. I can imagine many, many, many other factors figuring in. In fact, I would be surprised if it's something simple, you know, there is no sexual behavior, never mind, you know, complicated human behavior that boils down to something simple. All we have is enough of a clue that no theory can be complete without explaining these biological connections. So it leaves room for environmental stuff. We can't rule it out, but it doesn't work the other way around. There's no way that somebody can come in with a purely experiential learned explanation and say that that's the end of the story. That's not possible now because that has no explanation for these biological connections. So even though I have no reason to discount the interaction kinds of theories, there's no evidence yet demanding it. The only evidence we have demanding anything is that biology has to be there. We don't know how, we don't know in what way, but the simplest explanation is that people appear to be born either with this tendency, with this propensity, and it's built in and doesn't change. We have no evidence suggesting that, you know, these are brain areas that do change after maturation anyway.
Have you continued to do research on the brain of pedophiles? Or have you taken your findings? I mean, is it that new?
Well, and sex research is really exceptional among the sciences because there are so few people doing it. It's not like we have, you know, teams in every major hospital all competing, working with each other, you know, building on each other's findings. There's a pocket here, a pocket there, and a phenomenal public, I don't know if I should say interest or disinterest. There's disinterest in the sense that people don't want to touch this as radioactive, you know, to hospital administrators. This is not the kind of stuff that, you know, that is going to get money out of donors and so on. People are administrators and managers are really, really afraid of the optics of all of this.
It's quite bizarre when you consider that sexual orientation is fundamental to the identity of every single person. Why wouldn't more research be done?
You're asking the last person in the world who would know that. I think it's absolutely fascinating. I'm spending every minute I can to it, and I don't understand why everybody isn't a sex researcher. More realistically, again, this is a highly, highly controversial question. No matter what my results, no matter what the evidence is, some very large group of people is going to hate me, and they're not quiet about it.
Why is it so controversial?
It's the emotional evocativeness of the environment. There exist, you know, very many people in society who have been sexually molested as children. So the idea of taking a dispassionate, objective idea of what's going on, a lot of people don't want to hear about. A lot of people are angry. They're upset, they're vengeful, and people just want to punish. That's the only thing they know how to do. When we're talking actual offenders, I have an enormous amount of sympathy for that view. I mean, if I had been molested, it's very easy to imagine that I would have, you know, a similar set of emotions. but good decisions don't really come out of emotions. And I'm aiming for something bigger. As much as I understand the punitive reflex, if I can figure out what makes a person pedophilic in the first place, we might be able to prevent their having ever been a victim at all. So if that requires my sitting on my own emotions in order to take a dispassionate, Vulcan, only logical, stick to the evidence view, that's what I'm going to do. That doesn't mean I or any other scientist lacks any empathy for the victim, but the vengeance and the anger and the desire for retribution, or which sometimes they will euphemistically call justice, I get that. That makes sense. But all of that is after the fact. If I can get these people to come in and we can actually start studying people who will acknowledge their own pedophilia, tell me about it, take the tests, undergo my brain scans, the feedback I get from these people is that they, just like I in my own way, they also want to know, why are they different? They didn't ask for this. They don't want to be outcasts. They don't want to lack attraction to adults and therefore the kind of relationship where they can just kind of live a happy, healthy life of their own. Most of these people over and over again say that if I somehow developed a cure, a brain surgery that would turn them into regular, everyday, attracted to adults, they would take it. They want me to be able to prevent new cases of this in the future. They don't want other people to be saddled with a condition requiring that they essentially live a life of celibacy.
Have you compared the brains of offending pedophiles to non-offending pedophiles?
I haven't yet. Another laboratory has done something similar. The bottom line is that it's going to be a confused mess and we're not sure. What we are generally predicting, but none of us is able to found a political and legal environment where we can conduct the study needed. What we're predicting is that chunks of the brain are going to be related to sexual interest patterns, and another chunk of the brain is going to be related to criminality. And when we get people in the lab, we're going to see one, the other, or both. And in a control group, neither. The theory works out pretty neat, and there already exists a very, very substantial neurological literature in criminality in general. I mean, pedophilia, child molestation is not the only crime. Many, many other people who have committed many different kinds of violent crimes, as I say, we have a relatively substantial neurological literature on that, and we know which parts of the brain are more or less involved. So we have a prediction that we would love to be able to test. But in order to be able to test that, the laboratory, the scientist, the situation needs to be in a place where we, the scientists, can be able to get people who are able to acknowledge their pedophilia, come into a lab, sign their informed consent form, and not worry that they will get reported. That's tough. Not every jurisdiction has laws that will allow us to protect the confidentiality of people who volunteer as research subjects. But these laws, well-intended, are actually making things worse. They're getting in the way of research and they're getting in the way of clinicians, helping these people. I blame it on the laws, but that's only a piece of the story. A law is as a law is enforced. I keep saying law. A lot of these are professional regulations which are monitored by the official licensing boards, which monitors its own profession. Very often, these people will pursue a case that doesn't exactly fit, but they're worried about how it will look. And a lot of mental health professionals will shy away from cases because they don't want to have to defend themselves against these kinds of accusations. It has a chilling effect. And so even though technically the psychologist is not always mandated to report these cases, a lot of psychologists will report them anyway, just in case. The pedophiles, of course, know that. They are petrified of being reported and triple check all of this. And because a lot of psychologists, even though they can, won't guarantee the confidentiality. So these people don't come in, don't volunteer for studies, don't come in for therapy and so on. As I said, the mandatory reporting regulations really are making things worse.
I'm Kathy Kaler. This is Community in Conversation. And my guest this week is Dr. James Cantor. Dr. Cantor is an American-Canadian clinical psychologist and sexologist specializing in hypersexuality and paraphilias. He's a former senior scientist with the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, and I am looking at the brain science behind pedophilia. Dr. Cantor, many pedophiles claim to have been abused as children and will often claim that it's a factor that led them to pedophile behavior. What's your thought on
that? That has been a very common claim. Not as much now, really, as I would say up to about 20 years ago. It was believed for a long time, never with any solid evidence, but it was believed for a long time that being the victim of child sexual abuse is what caused somebody to become a child molester. So when somebody who is accused of it says that they actually were a victim of it, it's really, really tough to know, are they saying this because it's true, or are they saying this because they think it should be considered as a mitigating circumstance in their sentencing because it gains them some sympathy from whoever they're talking to. So even though it's been claimed often, it's never really been verified in any kind of objective way where anybody went back to look at records. Was anybody reported? Do we find those kinds of elevations? There's never really been solid evidence that it's true in a way that gives us any insight into what causes what. It is, however, extremely important to remember, especially for that research question, that pedophilia is not a synonym for child molestation. Pedophilia is the sexual interest pattern. They are turned on by kids in the same way that the rest of us are turned on by whatever it is that we're turned on by. That's different from the behavior. The behavior, which they cannot enact, is child molestation. For adults, it's sexual contact, or if it's adults with, you know, somebody who doesn't want contact with us, then it also is a sexual offense. What we do know from the science is that being raised in very chaotic environments is related to, in adulthood, leading a very chaotic environment. The connection that we found is that kids who are in adverse circumstances, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect, are more likely to engage in any of those same three when they themselves are heading families, whether it's physical, violent, non-sexual abuse, or sexual abuse, or neglect. The pattern appears to be chaos begets chaos. There doesn't seem to be a one-to-one connection between sexual abuse begets sexual abuse. It's just general yucky disinhibition, but any one of them can lead to any one of them. The observation, even when made, can be legitimate, but we have no evidence to suggest that there's a causal relationship between being a victim of childhood sexual abuse and pedophilia itself. The connection seems to be between abuse and abuse, and that relationship appears to be very general.
I'm Kathy Kaler. This is Community in Conversation, and my guest this week is Dr. James Cantor. Dr. Cantor is an American-Canadian clinical psychologist and sexologist specializing in hypersexuality and paraphilias. Something very important that you pointed out is that we have to draw a distinction between pedophiles and molesters. They are not one and the same. Somebody can be a molester without being a pedophile, and somebody can be a pedophile without being a molester. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, that is absolutely true. There is, of course, overlap, much smaller than what most people would think. Most people think that these are practically synonyms. They're not. When we get these people in the laboratory and we undergo formal testing, only roughly a third of child molesters are actually pedophilic. The majority of them, two-thirds of them, three-quarters of them, depending on the study, actually prefer adult sexual partners. And they use the kid really as a surrogate to fill in when they don't have access to some adult partner. These are most common in, for example, incest cases, whether it's a parent, step-parent, or sibling. Those are the majority kinds of cases. It's relatively rare. It's a third, so still substantial, but not even the majority. So it makes no sense to try to, you know, bring whatever clinical information we have about pedophilia to all of child molesters. To deal with child molestation, we need to deal with impulsivity, disinhibition, antisociality. Pedophilia itself is what makes these people pick their victim. But the real problem is that they are going to pick a victim, and that's what we need to deal with.
Do you have any idea of how many victims of molestation go on to perpetuate and become molesters?
That's a very interesting question. Unfortunately, there's no good way to get that number. The only thing really we can do is conduct a survey, but there's no way to conduct a survey of these people going forward to make sure that there's no selection bias. For example, some of these people never make themselves known. It's not reported to anybody. We don't know who they are, so there's no way to follow up with them later. The only thing, as I say, available to us is a survey. Well, if it's a survey and people are talking about, you know, what happened to them before, well, people who have gone through this kind of a situation and have something to say are more likely to take the survey. So we'll only end up with a warped sense of who these people are. And again, so there's no good way to get a number. It would overrepresent the people who were still dealing with it. And all of this would, again, depend on who's willing to admit that they actually are a pedophile to begin with. There is no good way to get the number moving forward. You know, we only have these couple of coincidental glimpses we get to have because of how the various systems work.
In your opinion, can molesters be rehabilitated?
The data show that. Actually, very few, surprisingly few, frankly, offenders actually go on to commit new offenses once they're caught. There was a study that looked at all other studies. It conglomerated all follow-up studies ever conducted with these people, put them all together and found among the 25,000 offenders, you know, in combination, 13.7% committed another offense against children. It's actually quite low. Most offenders commit only one offense or get caught, never commit another. Now, we don't know if that's because they got caught, because they no longer have access to children, because they learned their lesson, because of the rehabilitation associated with whatever they got while they were incarcerated or afterwards. But the idea that these people are automatically a serial, ongoing, matter of time risk appears to be false. I suspect that that's come out of the media, especially, you know, over the past 20 years, I'll say. The situations that get reported in the media are the serial abusers, the systematic ones, in churches, in the Boy Scouts in North America, and so on. You know, we hear more about these string offenders, and so that's, I think, what's often evoked in people's heads. The statistics don't bear that out. Once somebody's caught, they're unlikely to do it again.
No, we only ever hear about the offenders. We don't hear about the pedophiles who never offend.
And we only hear about the offenders who get caught.
Dr. Cantor, do you believe that pedophiles can be rehabilitated, offending pedophiles?
The evidence suggests that they can, but it's really tough to get solid numbers that would give us a solid answer to that question. We can only ask questions where we can, you know, dip our microphones in order to record data. If we want to know if somebody is, if we want to know if whatever course or strategy we're using to prevent rehabilitation is working, we need a group of people to whom we give those strategies, and we need a control group. We need somebody to compare them to. Now, that's, even though scientifically that's easy to say, that's a little tough to imagine in the real world. Here we're talking a sex offender released from prison, and now we're going to not give him treatment just to see what happens. That's a pretty ethically dicey situation. Even though it's the scientific way to answer the question, I'm not going to hold my breath for anybody randomly assigning pedophiles to not go into whatever rehabilitation is available. Realistically, we're left with what we usually call a naturalistic experiment. We find a situation, two different areas, for example, that resemble each other in every way we can find, demographics and so on, but differ in this particular law or procedure, so we could compare the outcomes in those two different jurisdictions. that's kind of what we're limited to. That's what we're watching out for. But nobody's found such a situation. At least if somebody has, I haven't seen a result of such a study. But that's why we really can't answer that question in a very straightforward way. We can ask the question, it's a great question, but actually doing what we need to do in order to figure it out is not likely to happen anytime soon. We just kind of have to put what we can together out of situations that are available. For example, there will be some jurisdictions that use different kinds of treatments. Some will use psychological treatments, some will use one-on-one therapy, some will use group therapy. So in those situations, we can look for whether there's a difference among these different kinds of therapies. But what we usually end up with is that they all pretty much have the same result, which is, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15% of these people reoffend. And because so many people have such a feeling of just vengeance, throw them in jail. Anytime I talk about this, people start emailing me with images of people in wood chippers. They don't want to rehabilitate. They want vengeance. Or at least they want to be able to tell their friends, you know, how wonderful they are because they, you know, said something about a wood chipper to a scientist. So as I say, so gathering the evidence is, the question is easy, but we haven't yet found a situation that really gives us a good definitive answer on whether or what kind of treatment works. We're in another situation where we're doing the best we can with what we have. The closest exception in the world is a group called the Prevention Project Dunkelfeld in Germany. Fascinating and very important project. Germany is a jurisdiction that has slightly different mandatory reporting laws from most of the rest of the world. Where I am specifically in Canada, other mental health professionals, other licensed healthcare professionals are required to report, as I say, you know, cases where a child is in need of protection. In Germany, mandatory reporting like that doesn't kick in unless murder is on the line. So if a pedophile goes to a psychologist in Germany and to say, "Doc, I'm having trouble, you know, keeping hands off my kid. The urge is strong. Help me." That doctor can then start working with that patient, you know, tell me about, you know, whatever it is, you know, willpower getting out of the environment, sex drive reducing medications, whatever might help that person. If that same person comes to a physician in Canada, they have to get reported. So what happens? The person never comes in to the physician in the first place, of course, especially because we all function under informed consent. I am required to tell you that if you tell me this, I will report you. So, of course, they are entitled and use the opportunity. Oh, OK, sorry, bad appointment. Bye. So, of course, those are the only two possible situations. You either have mandatory reporting or not. So either the person can tell you or not. So you are either in a place like Germany where the person can tell you, we know a kid is getting molested and we will do the best we can to stop it. Or the person never comes in to tell you and the kid continues getting molested no matter what. The idea that one should be required to report it, people think, okay, we have to save this kid. Okay, you've saved one kid and you've damned all of the others. I understand people's motivation to it, that, you know, the idea of having this knowledge and not doing anything with it, to most people are not half Vulcan and have trouble swallowing that emotion. But if a person just takes that line of logic one step further, they realize they're actually causing much more harm. They are enabling these cases of abuse to continue because they are preventing these people coming in where at least we would have a chance to help the ones coming in asking for help to stop. I want to be able to help these people, but everybody else, right, thinking that requiring me to report them will help, but they've actually made things worse by tying my hands. I say my hands, but really it's, you know, all of the mental health and related professions. The Prevention Project Dunkelfeld in Germany, because their mandatory reporting doesn't kick in until murder, they are actually able to see these people and provide and get them to whatever kind of therapy is appropriate to that case. And they are able to do this kind of research where they can take brain scans of people who are admitting to, acknowledging, and had not been caught. They came in on their own.
I don't know if you listened to that interview that I did with Bly Reid.
Yes, I did. Very good. He is really, really good. And your interview with him especially really highlighted, again, some really difficult, difficult points in a very, not just sympathetic. It wasn't, you know, a sob story, which, you know, a lot of stories can turn into, but it was just so rational, so lucid.
It's gone viral. It has been shared thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And I think that that's so important because we never hear about the non-offending pedophiles. Our experience as society is only ever when somebody has offended or molested. And that's why I think that society has two major problems. I think that one is that, you know, if you think of a teacher who draws a good person and an evil person, the evil person will look mean and they'll have mean eyes, but that's not the reality. Pedophiles can be incredible people. They can be very charitable. They're charismatic. And they have this problem. And if we can try and understand it, you know, you can't change what you don't acknowledge. And if we can try and understand it and educate our community, it's one step closer to acknowledging it. And I think that that's important. Otherwise, we're never going to get on top of this. As long as we keep doing the same thing, we're going to have this reaction.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
One of the things that I learned is that awareness of being a pedophile starts at around the age 14. That's when pedophiles usually become aware that they are pedophiles.
That sounds about right. There have been a couple of studies. That's pretty typical.
Around that time, the human brain is starting a process of pruning, where all the different centers in the brain that are not stimulated are pruned away, essentially. And that's why the ages between 14 and 16 are such difficult times for adolescents in terms of human development. Is there some way, and this is just me speaking to a brilliant man, is there some way that that process could be used in young people who identify as pedophiles, that maybe that part of their brain is pruned away? Is that a very simplistic way of looking at it?
It's just not a simple question.
Yeah.
Part of what makes it a good question, I like it very much. I hesitate to say that anything is off the table. I would be surprised if the developmental sequence is such that an intervention going on during pruning periods is what ultimately can make a pedophile not a pedophile, or vice versa. I have no proof for that. I'm just going by, you know, the kinds of things that we've seen of equivalent levels of complexity in other human behaviors. It just doesn't usually work out that way. That's not proof. And anybody with any whiff of evidence showing, you know, anything else, I am more than convertible. I am just going by, you know, the way these kinds of things usually work out. And I'm doing the best I can to offer that as nothing more than a guess. Tentative, more than tentative, just going by what we call the base, right? That's how it usually goes, but there exist lots of exceptions. If you show me evidence, I'll believe this is another exception. My main hesitancy is that we have never seen a similar pattern for any other sexual interest pattern. For males especially, sexual interest patterns really kind of emerge despite really what we want them to be. We want to be like everybody else. You know, we avoid, deny any evidence that we're unlike our peers, whether it's because we're interested in a different age range of them, if we're interested in the same instead of a different sex, if we're interested in a different kind of behavior, some kind of kink, whatever it is. For none of any of these have we ever really seen any kind of evidence that something, you know, during adolescence, when they're already, you know, mature enough to have sexual fantasies and masturbating and in many cases having sex, we really haven't seen any evidence of sexualities changing at that point. In fact, we often see for a lot of the paraphilias, for a lot of the atypical sexualities, and a lot of these people say out loud that they recall even in childhood being fascinated with whatever it is that later in life becomes the object of their fetish. For example, adult men who are into women's panties. To most men, they're kind of neutral. They're a means to an end. You know, any attraction they have to them is because they symbolize what's coming after. But for people with panty fetishes, it's the panties themselves they are attracted to. They prefer to masturbate alone with those panties than to have sex with the person. Even though they weren't masturbating and weren't able to express a sexual attraction like they can in teenagerhood, they recall a fascination with their sister's underwear, their mother's underwear, underwear that they saw, you know, on a clothesline. They knew that it was important, even though it didn't have the overtly erotic tinge that it had acquired when they went through puberty. So, as I say, because we have evidence that these people's brains are responding to these kinds of paraphilic objects differently already, and we have these links suggesting that something was going on in the brain even prenatally, it would take, as I say, some substantial evidence to suggest that teenagerhood is now impacting in a causal way rather than just reflecting the ongoing development of something that's already set up, already destined. For example, the rosebud is going to be the color it is before we see it. We're just watching it unfold as the person matures and develops, but there's nothing over the summer that's causing the rose. It's just nurturing it along, but what the rose is going to look like has already been set.
So outside of anything that I've been exposed to, so I cannot possibly just not ask you about these things.
But, as I say, I don't know why everybody isn't a sex researcher, but the stuff's fascinating. We're all at least amateur sex researchers. I just found a way to make a living at it.
You've got a very, very interesting job.
I am the luckiest scientist on the planet, and it makes it really, really easy to tolerate the various slings and arrows of all the people who don't like, you know, whatever scientific answer not matching up with whatever their politics is. Don't care. This stuff will keep me going forever. Well, it is indeed fascinating.
It really is fascinating. I have to tell you something that I have loved speaking to and listening to you, but that brain of yours is incredible. Dr.
Oh my goodness.
Cantor, thank you so much for your
pleasure. Sincerely was mine. And thank you for tackling such a tough area. There are very, very few journalists willing to stick their necks out with such a rough, evocative topic. So let me bounce all of that very much back to you.
Thank you very much to my guest expert, Dr. James Cantor. Dr. Cantor is an American-Canadian clinical psychologist and sexologist. He specializes in hypersexuality and paraphilias. He's a former senior scientist with the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. In summary, this interview has been part two of a series on pedophilia. Part one was an interview with a pedophile. You can find it on the High FM website and Spotify under Community in Conversation. Today's episode was about the brain science of pedophilia. Knowledge is power, and it's why I have done this series, to empower you with knowledge. Perhaps with better knowledge, we can find better and more effective ways to protect the children and adolescents in the community from sexual predators. In next week's episode, I will be discussing pedophilia in a South African context, how to talk to children about staying safe, and how to protect our communities. I'm doing it so that we stop whispering about it, so that we confront it, so that we strengthen our community, and so that we have the conversations that matter. I'm Kathy Kaler for Community in Conversation on 101.9 High FM.
It's a Community in Conversation. Join Kathy Kaler every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.